Welcome back to Small Biz Survival. This is Becky McRae, and I have cornered the famous author and economist, Michael Schumann. We are going to talk. He's the author of Small Mart Revolution, which is about small businesses that are succeeding in a global world today. He's also the author of Local Dollars, Local Cents, about local investing and what a difference that makes to local businesses. Welcome, and I'm very glad to have you, Michael.
Nice to be with you.
All right. So let's just start with this, the changing retail environment. The small town businesses are facing a world of change like they haven't faced ever before, or maybe unprecedented completely. So interestingly, we're coming to a point where even the big box stores are starting to feel some pressures from online business and the way that everything is changing today. So it's like a second wave even of change within this big wave of change. What can small town stores do to survive these days?
Right. Well, it's a very tricky problem. And I would say that it's good to start thinking about the problem from a kind of big picture perspective. And one of the big picture things that's changing is that we are going to see manufacturing come back to the United States in a very big way. And it's interesting, when you look at the breakdown in manufacturing, there's a big difference between so-called durable goods and non-durable goods. So durable goods are goods that stick around for a long time, things like electronics. And those are the things that have been produced offshore and probably will continue to be produced offshore in very low-wage countries in the foreseeable future. Non-durable goods are things like food, building materials, heavy things that you use a lot of. And these things, because they're heavy, they tend to have a high transportation cost. And when these things, when the transportation cost gets more expensive, when oil prices go up, these are the first things that we're going to localize. Now, it turns out that when you look at how a typical household spends its money, for every dollar they spend on a durable product, they spend $3 on a non-durable product. So that means that a huge number of the goods in our everyday life are going to start to move from overseas to being more locally or regionally produced. And you can already see this beginning to happen with local food. I would argue that a lot of the local food revolution is driven by the economics, the diseconomies of long-distance shipping of food from faraway places you don't trust. As goods become a lot closer to people, retail of those goods to people, is going to make a lot more sense. So the big consolidators, like whether they be store-based consolidators like Walmart or virtual consolidators like Amazon, the business model is not going to make sense for them to buy things, in communities around the country, re-centralize them, and then send them back out again. So I really think at the end of the day, this comeback of local production is going to invite a resurgence of local retail. But the retail is going to look different, okay? And again, you can see this in the food business, that, the kind of same old grocery store of yesteryear may not make sense. We may see stores that specialize in local produce. So not just a farmer's market, but something, more permanent and, run with greater sophistication. But I think you could see this with other kinds of local goods, local furnishings, local clothing. And it's those niches that I think will see an explosion of retail happening. So that's sort of just, one set of patterns that I sort of look forward to.
Yeah, I think in small towns where you don't really have enough market for there to be like the specialty, we only sell local produce store. I think we're going to see a lot more of those the stores that hopefully are locally owned. In a lot of cases, they are. In my own town of Alva, we have Alva's Market, which is a locally owned thing, completely independent. They have a hard row to hoe of staying competitive with across the town is Walmart and their globalization. But they have an ability to carry local produce in a way that's really local. Now, right. When Walmart labels it as local, they mean it came from somewhere in a 5-state area.
Right.
But if Alva's Market labels it as local, they'll probably tell you who grew it. And that's a whole different layer of information. And so while the whole store may not be dedicated just to local, they do local in a much more personal way.
Right.
And much more competitive.
That's right. And so, I mean, I think the big picture understanding that local retailers have now is that price is not enough.
Right.
And that is, you know, if you try to compete just on price, you may still win, because I do think there are a lot of goods where locals have a comparative advantage. I mean, Starbucks is still the most expensive cup of coffee in town, and so they're not winning on price. But I think that it is the quality of the place, it's the quality of the service, it's the integrity of the overall structure of the business, it's integration into the community. And so on those kinds of issues, local retailers can do a significantly better job. I also think that, you know, local retailers, and this is one of the great functions of business alliances, I mean, they need to be willing to hear difficult criticisms coming to them, say about, you know, the layout of their store, the hours that they keep, the way in which they do the marketing. And at the end of the day, I think, you know, every local retailer is going to have to realize that they are going to be stronger as part of a local team than just going it alone. So, you know, the more that local retailers do embrace local business alliances, I think the better their chance of survival is.
All right. And in a small town, frequently the local alliance is either your Chamber of Commerce or you have a downtown merchants association. We don't have as many independent business alliances that operate alongside those in small towns, but your Chamber of Commerce, even if you start your own networking group and just get your other businesses together and do it yourself, there is a great power to be had in connecting with your other business owners locally.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, one of the things I think that is a yet untested concept, not completely untested, but, you know, I could imagine that if you have three or four adjacent counties with a lot of small towns in there, not a lot, say five small towns and three adjacent counties, that in each town you could think about building a little bit of a local business center where representative products that were not represented in a town A drew products from towns B, C, D, and E. And in a way, you provided an entry point for those other local retailers in the region to enter into the community. And I think, you know, one can start to conceive of achieving a greater level of kind of local self-reliance, even in rather sparsely populated areas.
I can see that, where sometimes you'll have like a really great clothing store in one town, and clothing's notoriously mm-hmm. hard to do in a small town, and so you have a great company, they're able to make it work in this small town. Could you make an easy entry point to get them into your town as well, and to use that as a starting point, and then maybe at the same time, or in the same building, or leveraging the same empty building that you're taking over and doing something new with, bring in some other retailer from another town that's really great with, you know, there's a great appliance store in a small town near you. Another notorious
right.
hard thing to do in a small town. But it's big, heavy goods that are hard to ship. And
right, exactly. And so you know, I mean, among the success stories that I think begin to put some of these dots together are these community stores like in Saranac Lake or Port Townsend, where they create, you know, these little department stores to fill in gaps. But it turns out when you look at the economics of these things, the single biggest expenditure that they have is inventory. So if you can create a set of relationships between your ostensible community store and a bunch of other stores in the region that are providing the inventory, the cost of starting this thing up is a lot more reasonable. So I haven't seen a community quite do this yet, right. But just as you sketch it out on paper, it looks like it could work.
Yeah. Well, we're not above dabbling in dreams around here. We're okay with that. So how about this? Is there one thing that small retailers in small towns should definitely not do? Because, I mean, is there something that we should stop doing?
Well, there's a lot of things that you should stop doing. We've already talked about just focusing on price.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about going it alone.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about not being open to criticism about how you're actually running your business. But let's talk about other things that I think small businesses should be very wary of. They should be wary of economic development promises that the town will be saved by one big company or one big project being done, and everyone should rally behind that. And we should understand that these projects are, we now empirically know with a vast amount of evidence that they are total wastes of time and money. And, especially in a small town with limited resources, every single dollar of public money and economic development needs to be focused laser-like on the nurturing of other local businesses. And every single hour of an economic developer's time needs to be focused on these businesses. So the moment you have an economic developer who talks about a big corporate attraction, they should be fired immediately and you start all over again.
Amen. I'm just going to add that for everybody that's listening, because a bunch of people just went yes out loud wherever they are hearing that, because it's a continual thing, and there's a lot of legacy economic developers that are in small towns who are continuing to focus on, we're going to recruit the one big thing that's going to save our town, at the same time that they're ignoring that for the same $50,000 that they're investing in that, they could invest in 10 small businesses with $5,000 each and generate more economic impact for the town.
Absolutely. And, honestly, the biggest obstacle to economic development right now is economic developers, and we've got to fix that problem.
Okay, now I will say there are some economic developers who listen.
Yes.
By and large, great people who are the ones who are focusing on their local businesses.
Right.
And focusing on we can fix this from within, as opposed to waiting for the savior who's going to come from somewhere outside.
Right. And I love what those folks do, but I feel like the profession overall has created this sort of these false gods of attraction and retention. I mean, when you listen to dialogues in economic development conventions, the words attraction and retention trip off the tongue at the baud rate about once every 25 seconds. And it's so silly, because you cannot attract a local business. It's an oxymoron. You cannot retain a local business, because if you're actually struggling to retain it and its roots are not very deep to begin with, and you better not call it local.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Now, you have a book coming out that I heard just today. I didn't even know about this until
just today. Yeah, so the book that I'm working on now is called tentatively called Reinventing Economic Development. And the title is meant to evoke a little bit a book that came out about 25 years ago called Reinventing Government.
Yes.
And Reinventing Government was all about how do you take big lumbering public policy and turn it into entrepreneurial programs that pay for themselves. And one of the oddest things about economic development is that those who would be promoting entrepreneurship are the least un-entrepreneurial people in our midst. That is that, you know, all they can think about is how do you get this next chunk of government money or this next big grant. So what interests me are what are economic development programs that pay for themselves? And those are the kinds of programs that we should be embracing. And I say this as much for the benefit of you know, economic developers who are into the attraction paradigm as economic developers who are into local business support. So, you know, you can imagine it, there's, you know, two broad ways you can do a local purchasing campaign. One way is put a lot of placards up around your town and a lot of literature and brand awareness, and all of this costs money. Another way of doing it might be a local loyalty card that actually can generate a cash flow that covers the person who administers it. So really what the book is about is programs with respect to local purchasing, local investing, local entrepreneurship, and business partnerships, sort of business alliances that actually are paying the bills.
You mentioned just briefly, as you went through there, local investing. And as the author of Local Dollars, Local Cents, I would be remiss if we didn't spend some time and talk just briefly about local investing. I really think that nothing has more capacity to remake our small towns than shifting the amount of money that people in that town have invested in large banks elsewhere and in mutual funds that do not provide any investment. If we can shift any of that money that's already in our towns, it's owned by people in our towns, if we could shift any of that into investing in our towns, we could make a huge difference in small towns.
Absolutely. And I think it's useful to just put some data on the table around this.
Now, the Economist is going to let loose with the data. All right.
All right. just a few numbers. So, I mean, if you look at Americans' long-term savings, which is mostly for their pension funds and retirement.
And other retirement funds, not a lot of pensions.
Yeah, right. So yeah, I'm using pension broadly there.
Yeah.
But you know, in this category are stocks, bonds, mutual funds, pension funds, and insurance funds. All of these dollars add up for the American public to about $30 trillion. So that's one number, $30 trillion long-term investment. Our economy is, roughly speaking, half small, medium, and local, mm-hmm. and the other half is big and non-local. So if we had a capital market that was operating efficiently, roughly speaking, half of that $30 trillion would be going to the local economy and half would be going to the global economy. Right now, all of it is going to the global economy, which means that every single person listening to this podcast is systematically overinvesting in Wall Street and underinvesting, that is not investing at all, in critical businesses on Main Street. If we can get this right, there will be a $15 trillion shift to Main Street, which works out to about $50,000 per person. So, you know, if your town has 1,000 people, that's $50 million more of investable capital that you have to play with. If you have 10,000, you know, That's like half a billion dollars.
Now starting to run into money now.
Yeah, exactly. So I think, you know, getting this one piece right, and another way of looking at this, I think, is that this is the single biggest subsidy that we give to big business, is obsolete securities laws that deny small business everyone's long-term retirement capital. And this subsidy is long overdue for abolition. We're beginning to make some progress on it. And I think the Jobs Act, Jumpstart Our Business Act, which President Obama signed into law in April 2012, makes some good steps. It hasn't quite been implemented yet, but will be.
Eventually.
So they say, so
eventually.
They promise, right? You know, yeah. Right, by 2043, it should be implemented.
Any second now, yeah.
But probably by the end of this year. And that will That will mean for a small business that is seeking somewhere between $100,000 and $1 million in capital, they should be able to obtain that on a website where people can, you know, contribute amounts and small dollar amounts. And the cost of doing that will be about $5,000 to $15,000 of the money that they raise, which is a significantly lower cost than what they would face today to do the same thing.
You gave today some sort of the 10 steps, top 10 things that could be done like at the state level. And I'll share that with everybody so that they see what those top 10 steps were. But there's lots of things that can be done at the state level. And you also mentioned a number of things that are going on internationally, things that are happening in Nova Scotia and Canada and other places all over where local investing is becoming much more of an active front. Is there something that a business owner themselves can do to either help this along or a way that they could access capital now that maybe they weren't able to even a few years ago? That's a pretty broad question, wasn't it?
I think so remember, you know, a small business owner is also a small bank or a credit union or a financial advisor. And so let's remember that in this local investment universe, I mean, there are emerging business opportunities for bankers to reinvent themselves in the ways that they serve the public, and ways of local investment advisors to reinvent themselves and serve the public and promote local investment. But I think, you know, I think there is a role for businesses. I think businesses ought to try to raise more money from their customers. I mean, since your focus is, well, not exclusively, I mean, you're very interested in retail businesses. Retail mm-hmm. businesses are the easiest businesses to do crowdfunding around because you have a loyal group of customers that usually when you get them to invest, they become more loyal, and they start to become your great marketing force to encourage friends and neighbors to buy from you as well. So I hope that, you know, in small towns, we identify two or three great local business opportunities and make them, you know, big community goals to get these things funded. And they then, you know, and maybe, you know, if you imagine two or three businesses a year in a small town become the focal point, in 10 years you got 30 new businesses.
Yeah. We see a lot of utility cooperatives that offer local relending funds where they have a revolving loan fund. We also see it a lot in small municipalities where they'll start a small, and they get these funds through the federal government. USDA provides a lot of them in the United States. I think those are a great tool when they're used well. There's one in my area that's focused specifically on making capital purchases so that businesses can acquire equipment that they wouldn't have funding to do otherwise. And that's a great leverage point because when you let a business acquire new equipment that helps them step up to a new level, there's going to be a new level for the business. They're going to move into, they're going to need more people, they're going to be buying more stuff, the whole thing is going to change a whole section of the economy with a relatively small loan for a piece of equipment.
Right. And so the only caveat I would put in there is that I think the history of the last 10 or 20 years is that, you know, to the extent that we've made any progress in improving capital availability to small business, it's been in the form of debt.
Yeah.
And many small business people are just either they're up to their ears in debt, or they're sick in debt, or they're just getting out of debt and don't want to get back into it, or they, you know, they had a big fight with their spouse about putting their house on the line for a USDA loan, and they promised we'll never do it again, and they don't want to go down that road again. So I think for, you know, those kinds of individuals, those kinds of entrepreneurs, we really need to look at equity sources of capital. And I think that a growing number of Americans are willing to put equity into smaller businesses. That's what's exciting about this sort of crowdfunding revolution, is that, you know, when people put $100 into a business, they're not expecting to get rich, but it's an important form of economic support.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things that you've mentioned and that you've proposed is the $100 exemption, which would allow any investor to invest, not just loan, but invest $100 into any business as an ownership equity stake.
Right.
I think that's an awesome tool.
And with no lawyers.
With no lawyers. I just love this idea. I think what a small town could do, if everybody in the town had the ability to invest just $100
right.
in all the businesses around them that they wanted to. You know, even if you only scraped together $10, you could invest that because it's under the $100 exemption.
Right. And look, you know, all of these things are risky.
Sure.
But the virtue of something that's $100 and in a small town is that people are really likely to know the business, know the entrepreneur.
Exactly.
And it's those that personal relationship that is really the best guarantee for the integrity of the endeavor.
Yeah. We all know who we should invest in.
Yes, and who you shouldn't.
And who we shouldn't.
Right, exactly. If it's someone you haven't heard of who's just come to town, I would say not a good candidate.
No, not yet. Not yet. Let them hang around a while, get to know them.
Right.
And then you can decide if they're a good investment. I really appreciate you taking time to talk with me today. I know you've had a busy day and you have a lot of people who had demands for your time. I appreciate you taking time to talk to the small town people today.
Oh, my pleasure.
And thank you everybody for listening, and we'll talk to you again soon.
All right.